Come try new Skyline Dip Cholitos at your neighborhood Skyline today. A warm, soft tortilla filled with their amazing chili and cheese with an extra layer of cream cheese and crunchy Fritos corn chips at participating Skyline restaurants for a limited time.
Hello, everyone. It's Tom Slater here, editor of Spiked. Before we get into this week's brilliant episode of the Spiked podcast, I just want to remind you all that we still have some signed copies left of Brendan O'Neill's brilliant new book, After the Pogrom, the 7th of October, Israel and the Crisis of Civilization. If you want to get your hands on one of these, all you've got to do is donate £50 or more to Spiked while stocks last. And we'll also throw in a year's subscription to Spiked supporters, our online donor community, where you get access to all kinds of other exclusive perks. To get your hands on one of these and your year-long Spiked supporters membership, just go to spiked-online.com/donate and make your donation. That's spiked-online.com/donate. And now, on with the show. Hello and welcome back to the Spiked podcast. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, filling in for Fraser Myers in the hot seat this week. I'm delighted to be joined by two brilliant guests, Ian Atchison, who's a senior advisor at the Counter Extremism Project and the author of the book Screwed. How are you doing, Ian?
I'm very well, thanks. Thanks for the plug.
Not at all. And we're also delighted to be joined, returning guest to the show, Paul Embry, also an author of the book Despised and of the Paul Embry Substack. How are you doing, Paul?
Very well, thanks, Tom.
So we've got a lot to talk about today, a lot of very thorny issues. We're going to talk about the killing of Chris Cabra and the acquittal of the police officer in that case. We're going to talk about the tragic suicide in prison of Peter Lynch, one of the rioters from the summer. Then we're also going to take a look at the US and the revival of the Trump is a fascist smear, and also has Keir Starmer been meddling in the US election? Ian, to kick things off, let's talk about Chris Cabra. So this has been a huge story in the UK this week. Back in 2022, Chris Cabra, a 24-year-old man, was shot by police in the midst of a pursuit. This week, we finally saw the conclusion of the trial of the police officer who shot him. He was cleared by a jury of murder. And since then, we've also learned a lot about Chris Cabra himself, the fact that he was involved in gang crime, the fact that a few days before he met his untimely end, he'd also shot a rival in a nightclub. But what's been striking is, I guess, the acquittal of the officer in question, Martin Blake, as well as these new details about Chris Cabra and the sort of life he was leading up until the point that he tragically died, haven't necessarily dented the narrative. This was very much cast in a sort of racial script, I suppose, and it doesn't feel like we've moved on that much. What have you made of the conversation about
it? Well, I think you're right. It was cast in a racial script, and people fell over themselves, politicians included, to amplify that narrative well in advance of the court case, which is now concluded. And I think it's important to just emphasize something that you said there. Chris Cabra wasn't there to be shot by a Metropolitan Police officer by accident. Mm-hmm. That was the culmination of a violent criminal lifestyle that put him behind a car. We see from the evidence, putting other officers and potentially members of the public at mortal risk. So I'm afraid he's the author of his own misfortune. Nobody should leave home expecting to be shot. But, you know, I'm afraid the evidence is quite clear that, he was legitimately killed. The jury has acquitted him of murder. Certainly Sir Mark Rowley has finally come out and said, you know, he believes the system for policing the police through independent Office for Police Complaints is not fit for purpose. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I am actually delighted today to hear the Home Secretary come out and say there has to be, you know, a presumption of good faith when these incidents occur. Police aren't above the law. That's really important. They enforce the laws that they're also subject to. But, you know, I think when this incident happened and the police officer's identity was revealed, and what we now hear are allegations that there's a bounty mm-hmm. put in his head, are completely unacceptable. The balance has totally shifted here, away from a presumption of innocence towards a kind of institutional presumption of guilt, which is incredibly corrosive. Mm-hmm. Because as Mark Rowley said, you know, decent police officers, of whom the vast majority are, who go out to protect the public. I was a volunteer police officer, and I'm, you know, in awe of the bravery of many of my regular colleagues running towards danger where other people would run away. They deserve our support and protection. They don't deserve to be excused from misbehaviour. But I think that that presumption, that balance has skewed far too far towards criminal classes and far too much towards a narrative that says, well, you know, if he's not guilty of this, we'll get him for something else.
Absolutely. And Paul, were you struck by the rush to judgment that took place after this incident? Because all we knew really was that this killing had taken place. It was in the midst of some kind of police investigation, police pursuit. We then found out that he wasn't actually armed at the moment that it took place. But subsequently, you know, aside from his kind of criminal history, which was kind of irrelevant to the moment itself, he was in the process of trying to ram his way out of this kind of police cordon that had been set up around him. And yet, on the basis of basically nothing, there were many people, including quite prominent politicians, willing to either say explicitly or heavily imply that this might have been a racist police shooting, you know, kind of evoking the sort of images of what might have happened in America. Were you surprised by that? Or do you think we are just kind of downstream of a lot of that American BLM narrative these days?
No, I wasn't surprised by it at all, actually, because I think we do have, we've created in this country a huge racial grievance industry. So I think that whatever the actual facts were around the shooting, I think that there were always going to be people, including people in prominent positions, who were going to come out and speak the language of police racism and injustice and the black community being targeted and so on. I take the view, look, of course we don't celebrate the death of Chris Cabba. There's a family that's grieving after all, but neither do we make him a martyr. He was somebody who in life caused considerable suffering to other people, had a criminal record going back many years, was a member of a notorious gang. And as I say, we've got that grievance industry in this country where we have, I think, inculcated in particular groups this sense of victimhood, almost like a permanent sense of victimhood. And I think the reaction from some people to the shooting was entirely fed by that. And if you live in a society as we do, where we have certainly within the upper echelons of our society, this obsession of constantly promoting separateness and difference between people and telling people that actually they are different and they need to be treated differently and they were treated differently in the past and therefore they're entitled to have that sense of injustice. I think the whole thing has been incredibly divisive, which is why some of the reaction I think was entirely predictable. But actually, you know, what I've been struck by, this idea that the black community as a whole have been traumatized by the affair, I think is actually insulting to a lot of black people, because I think to treat black people as that kind of homogenous blob where actually they are all in sympathy for Chris Cabba and they all believe that a terrible injustice has been served. Actually, I've seen quite a few black people come out and say, look, I'm not part of that vibe. The people making that case don't speak for me. And in fact, distancing themselves from the whole campaign. So, you know, I think that's to their immense credit that they've done that. But I think some of the narrative in terms of trying to present this as an injustice that is being felt by the whole black community, I think is just deeply wrong.
And then there was a striking couple of examples of that, one of which was this BBC News piece where they had dispatched some of their reporters to Croydon to talk to people in South London. And I think the original headline was exactly as you were saying, Paul, you know, black Londoners traumatized by the killing of Chris, or the acquittal of Chris Cabba's killer. They then had to very hastily edit it after they got a lot of backlash. I think there was another Guardian piece where again they kind of sent someone out to Brixton to kind of ask how people were doing. Were you struck by this as well, Ian? The kind of sense in which there's a pre-existing script that seems to come almost from the top down at moments like this, almost encouraging people to read this through that lens of grievance.
Well, I think there is to some extent, but some extent, it's also understandable because we have had multiple police scandals recently involving serving police officers raping and murdering people. So, you know, I don't think it's entirely unreasonable for people to be suspicious and skeptical. And I think that follows a trait across our institutions, where trust in our institutions, generally speaking, including the BBC, if you want to call it an institution, is in decline. But you know, what I always see when these things happen, when these narratives develop, is a fairly useless institutional response. Mm-hmm. A sort of timidity to be able to go out and challenge some of those narratives. You know, a lot of the MPs that were standing in solidarity with Chris Cabot and saying, as Paul has alluded to, this is, you know, of course, a function of the oppression. People feel this is just the lethal end of it by the state and so on. None of those people have got the slightest amount of humility in what they're doing. I'd be very surprised indeed, pick me up off the floor, if some of these MPs particularly, and they were, you know, almost exclusively Labour MPs, stood up and said, actually, I think I've got that wrong. And certainly, you know, what Paul has just said there about lumping together the black community in one sort of patronising generic blob is, you know, feeds into that sense, you know, directed often by, you know, white middle class journalists, that you know, there has to be that grievance narrative that must be fed, because of course that sticks eyeballs to screens, let's not forget.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly a huge part of it. And without wanting to lean into the ad hominem, it was also striking how a lot of the protests after the acquittal on Monday were very Caucasian, for lack of a better phrase. It speaks to, on some level, to what community, shall we say, actually resonates with it.
I wonder if Jon Snow turned up for Channel 4 and said he had never seen so many white people in his life. I don't think he did on that occasion. No,
exactly. He was conspicuous by his absence. But Paul, am I being overly optimistic to say that this hasn't been a situation in which this has been crowbarred into that narrative completely? The attempt to kind of turn Chris Cabot into Britain's George Floyd has kind of run aground of the facts, broadly speaking. The debate in Parliament this week was actually more leaning towards, at least from the front benches, how can we ensure that officers aren't put on trial too readily, rather than it being in the other direction? I mean, is there at least, can we at least comfort ourselves that we're not quite as far down the road towards kind of American style racial mania as we might otherwise be?
Yet, but we do tend to follow where America leads. So who knows where we'll be in a few years' time. But yeah, facts matter in cases like this. And I think if you're a politician, and look, there are politicians who quite understandably campaign against racism in society. And that is an entirely creditable cause. And good luck to politicians who do that. But I think around these sorts of issues, which are very fact sensitive, you need to avoid being too quick out of the blocks and rush into judgment. Very, very few people knew what had happened in the immediate hours after that incident occurred. And yet some politicians decided to speak as if they knew immediately that an injustice had been dealt and that someone had essentially been executed by the police. And these people have got influence. And this is the sort of thing, this narrative, if it catches, can cause riots on the street, frankly. And I think when it comes to something like this, you do need to exercise a bit of caution. If you do have public influence like that, you need to say, look, the process is the process and it needs to take place. And of course, if the process concludes that an innocent man has been killed and there was no justification for it, look at the Sean Charles de Menezes killing on the tube 20 years ago, whatever it was now. Of course, that needs to be exposed, and where people have done wrong, they need to be held to account. But I don't think there was any real evidence in the immediate aftermath of this incident that might be the case. So it does make you think that people just jumped on the bandwagon. And I tend to agree with Ian, those people should perhaps have a bit of humility now and say, look, we were too quick in rushing to judgment. And actually to say the police officer has been acquitted, that should be respected. And yes, you know, we should look as Parliament, as politicians, at how we can better protect police officers in the future. I mean, I think it's such a difficult job for police officers. I've got many criticisms of the police as an institution, but if you're a police officer and you're in the firearms unit, you are literally, I think, risking your career and sometimes your personal freedom when you go to an incident. And if you have to open fire, you know there is going to be the mother of all investigations, as there should be, but you also know that there's going to be a lot of people calling for you to be found guilty of murder and jailed. And I pay tribute to the police officers who put themselves in that position, because it's not something that I would want to do.
And let's move on to talk about another very thorny topic, which has been in the news this week, Ian, and that is the tragic death of Peter Lynch, who was one of the people who got caught up in this summer's riots. He was arrested in Rotherham, if I'm remembering correctly. He is not someone who, as far as we can tell from what the judge said as he was handing down his pretty lengthy, more than 2-year sentence, that he wasn't someone who was involved in the violence necessarily, but was someone who was very much involved in the mob, if you like. He was gesticulating, he was shouting at police officers, he was getting into a bit of a tussle with police officers to some extent. It was revealed this week that he had tragically taken his own life in prison, and it has, I suppose, sparked those debates again about whether or not, in the midst of and in the wake of the summer's riots, whilst everyone was behind locking up the violent individuals and the people who were menacing asylum seekers and so on, was there an overreaction with some of the edge cases, which I guess Peter Lynch is being presented as? What do you make of this whole discussion?
That's a really interesting point about overreaction. Sometimes a disproportionate response is the right response, and the state has a role in handing down exemplary sentences as a deterrent. Now, you know, compare us to France. You know, in France, they riot every Wednesday. The last time we had comparable social unrest in this country, to a much greater scale, incidentally, was in 2011. And at that point, also, there was exemplary sentences handed down to 5,000 people who were arrested during those riots, which are much greater in scale and potency. And they followed the killing of Mark Duggan, as you'll probably remember, than what happened over the summertime. And also, it's interesting that to the data that I'm aware of those people who were sentenced, 70% in 2011 and about the same, perhaps a little bit more, in 2024, had previous criminal convictions. Now, it's important to say a couple of things about poor Mr. Lynch. Mm-hmm. First of all, he didn't have any previous convictions. This was his first time in custody. You probably are aware, Tom, I used to be a prison governor, and I have opened the door on people who've take their own lives. And we're not entirely sure yet whether that is the case, actually, because there needs to be an inquest, mm-hmm. and there needs to be an investigation by the prisons and probation ombudsman. But the working assumption is that he took his own life. And that is a total tragedy. And I have, my sympathy extends to his family. There is an issue of saying, was that a disproportionate sentence for what he was involved in? And that's quite complex, actually, because he was part of an ecology during that riot, which was very, very serious and led to, around where he was, led to a hotel being set on fire with human beings inside it. The point I'd like to raise is a slightly different one, and that is, having dealt with managing suicidal people in custody, I think that given his age, given his infirmity, mm-hmm. He suffered from diabetes and angina, given the fact this was his first time in custody, and given the profile of the offence for which he was sentenced, he must have been surely considered to be screened for being at risk of suicide. There is a process called ACT, which is a national process in prisons. What I want to know is, there are other questions to answer, philosophically about whether he was sentenced or not. But were those processes put in place? Mm-hmm. Because I can tell you this, even today, the Chief Inspector of Prison released a report on Wandsworth, which was a red flag notification, where effectively the Chief Inspector had walked out of Wandsworth because it was so awful. So our prisons are in chaos anyway. That's the backdrop to what may have happened to poor Mr. Lynch.
And Paul, what was your take on this story when you saw it?
I have no particular issue with people who wreak havoc and violence on their community being sent to prison. I think people, if that's what they do, particularly people who set fire to hotels with innocent people inside, I think they deserve a very long stretch in prison, actually. And anyone who smashes up their community or inflicts violence on other people, yes, they deserve to see the inside of a prison cell, no question about it. My problem with this particular case is, as we know, he didn't attack anyone physically. I think that's been confirmed. He didn't physically attack anybody, this Peter Lynch. He clearly lost his rag at the protest that he was attending, and he shouted some pretty unpleasant things. And he was, as Ian described it, part of that ecology of that particular incident. But I'm uncomfortable with the length of the sentence that this guy received, and some of the sentences that some other people involved in the protests, whether physically or online, have received. And I think there is a legitimate case to say that we are seeing a degree of selective justice, a selective tough justice, if you like, because we all know, because we read the stories in the newspapers and we see them every day. I'm sure Ian sees them as much as probably more than anybody else. And it's extremely frustrating, I think, for many citizens in this country to see the number of cases where people who have committed serious crimes, pretty horrendous crimes, actually, in some cases, quite often walking free from court. They'll get a suspended sentence or they'll get a community order or whatever. And I wrote a piece on my Substack actually a few days ago where I compared Lucy Connolly, who was one of the other people who got sent to prison for a long time for something she said online, to a case where in the same month that she was arrested, a man was convicted because he beat up a complete stranger on a street in Lincolnshire. He punched him, he kicked him, he left him lying unconscious in the middle of the road. The victim suffered lasting damage, physical and psychological. And the assailant got a suspended sentence and walked free from court. I think that really angers people, actually. And I don't think it's necessarily that they support the rioters or they support what some people posted online. But they just think, well, hold on a second. We have been so ineffective as a country and so useless as a country apprehending criminals, punishing criminals. We've got this, and I know it's a bit of a cliche, but it is a true one, I think. This soft touch justice system. And I think people do get angry with that. And especially as we see now with the recent early release of prisoners and all of the publicity around that and people coming out and being picked up by Bentleys and saying, thank you, Keir Starmer. And some of them have been found guilty of kidnapping and that's why they were in prison and so on. And I think there is a sense that some of these people are political prisoners. And I don't say that lightly, and probably political with a small p, but in the sense that they've been made examples of, probably for political reasons, I think there's a case to say that they probably do deserve that status in some cases.
I can't accept Paul's point, and I know he qualified it by saying small p, that these people in any way qualify as political prisoners. There's no ideology behind burning a library or looting a vape shop, frankly. A lot of people were caught up in nihilistic violence, that the people who were caught up in the violence didn't follow any particular, ideology apart from their own self-interest when they were looting shops and robbing and so on. A lot of them were very bored. Some of it was mobilized by far-right neo-fascist sentiment, but quite a lot of that, we're now told by some of the research that's being done, was down to hostile state actor intervention, trying to sort of foment social disorder in the country, or extreme right-wing actors from outside the country. So, I can't get there. I do think it is absolutely legitimate, though, for people to say, why is our criminal justice system so broken? Why is, for example, with criminal activity, behavior so disconnected from consequence? And I'm talking about criminal behavior, generally speaking. Places where I come from, a working class housing state where I come from in Northern Ireland, you see the social disintegration taking place there, where people, there's sort of zones of criminal impunity, as I would call them, well away from the kind of postcodes that middle-class criminologists live in, where people, you know, the only authority that they see day to day, if they see any at all, is a parking attendant with a stab vest on. You know, community policing has all but disintegrated. The little corner shops, which were the glue that held these communities together, are being overwhelmed by people who commit multiple, you know, shoplifting to feed a drug addiction. So, you know, when you're marooned in that postcode and you then see people who are treated in this way, it certainly will get propagandized and is being propagandized. But, you know, as always with propaganda, there's a core of truth in it. And I think, you know, we've got disconnected communities and, you know, we're often told about Muslim communities in the northeast of England, a lot around some of the middle towns that seem to be disconnected from mainstream British life. I think the same applies to some places that have got white communities that feel disconnected, where the community morale has been shattered and so on. And we need to find a way, if we're going to stop riots happening again, and if we're going to not need these exemplary prison sentences, which seemed to have an effect in 2011. I don't know if that's going to be the case now, in order to deal with some of the consequences. And so much of the rioting and violence and disorder that happened this time around absolutely maps places socioeconomically where they're in the skip. Mm-hmm.
No, absolutely. And it's also worth saying that there were a lot of things around in 2011, which I think were fair cause for concern. You know, instances of young men who just set up a Facebook group calling for disorder. No one ever attended and they both got 4 years in prison. This is a pattern that we've seen repeat itself before. And if we're to be consistent, I suppose we should reflect on that slightly. But Paul, we're fast running out of time. I want to get on to Trump and fascism and all that good stuff. But is there anything short that you want to add here before we move on?
Yeah, just briefly. I mean, I go some way with Ian on what you just said. I mean, there was certainly an element of nihilism about it where people just did for the sake of it, in many cases, I think, went out and smashed up their community because that's just what they decided to do. But I do think, actually, that for many people who, not the worst of the idiots who caused the violence, but maybe some people who went onto the streets and millions of people who didn't go onto the streets, there is a burning sense of resentment in some of those communities that may not always be articulated particularly well. And it's almost like an inchoate kind of movement, force, if you like. But it exists. There is an awful lot of unhappiness and resentment and tension in many of our communities over issues like economic injustice and crime and immigration and integration and social disintegration.
We could spend the whole podcast talking about this very thorny issue, but let's move on to our final topic, which is turning towards America and the final few weeks, getting into the final days almost of this election campaign. So the Democrats have decided to pull out a very novel new attack line against Donald Trump, which is to accuse him of being a fascist, is to claim that he is essentially an acolyte of Hitler. The hook for this, I should say, is that one of his former chiefs of staff, there were of course many during his kind of carousel of a administration, John Kelly, has given an interview to the New York Times in which he's suggested that at various points Trump said that you know, Hitler did some good things. I want generals like Hitler. It's hard to imagine anyone mouthing these things with a straight face, and we don't really know the context. But regardless, it's been leapt upon by the Democrats. Kamala Harris has given a speech in which she has, again, kind of revisited some of these arguments that Joe Biden probably made more than she has, which is that Trump is just a threat to democracy, that he wants to drag America in a much more authoritarian, maybe even fascistic direction. What do you think of this, Ian? Do you think this is going to stick, or does it smack of desperation?
It's utterly depressing, the whole thing, because you think there's 365 million people in the United States, and the narrative comes down to between the two people who are vying to be the next president. A guy who wants to wipe his backside with the US Constitution and a woman whose words are basically compostable before they come out of her mouth. And that's the choice that we're being given, and those are the polarities that are, you know, being described. So you know, Trump says bad things all the time. Whether or not they're to be given any weight and taken seriously, I don't know. I tend to think, and I, you know, this could be really naive, and I could be proven terribly wrong, that the Constitution of the United States, framed by people who are escaping English tyranny, let's not forget, rooted in freedom and the separation of powers, will be strong enough to deal with any tendencies of any incumbent to be too authoritarian. But, you know, that choice is for Americans in a couple of weeks' time. And I just like it to be finished. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd like the result to be known. I hope actually the
Make
result
it stop.
Is. I hope the result is decisive.
Yes,
actually,
absolutely.
I hope to God it's not wafer thin in either way, because we do need the United States to be strong in a multipolar, very very dangerous world, mm-hmm. and stand up for some of the values that forged the North Atlantic alliance between ourselves and the United States, but obviously all the other countries in Europe too. We should have that preserved. And I guess, you know, if I was a US voter, I'd be thinking of not that, frankly. I'd be thinking about what's happening to me in my life and the eternal question, the economy stupid, mm-hmm. that we'll get asked in this after 4 years of Bidenomics and the prospect of 4 more years of the same. Is my life going to be any better? And I think we miss that in the kind of macro kind of nonsense that we love to indulge in about, you know, is America going fascist, or, you know, is it turning into a kind of progressive hellhole?
Yeah.
In the end, I think that's what Americans are going to vote on. Who is likely to give them a better life? And actually, fundamentally, that's what most people vote mm-hmm. on the basis of.
No, absolutely.
In any country.
No, and it is worth saying that there's kind of a competing politics of fear on both sides to a certain extent of this election. If you listen to your average kind of Trumpist apparatchik, then Kamala Harris is a full-blown communist. Yeah. If you listen to the Harris side, then Trump is a fascist, as we've learned about this week. But Paul, the fact that this slur is constantly trotted out, I mean, aside from anything else, it's not working, is it? Looking at how close the polls are at this point.
It is. I think Ian used the word depressing. It is really depressing. I remember during our general election over here earlier this year, and that guy who asked Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer, are you two the best that we've got?
And you think, very good moment, that.
Yeah. Actually, you know, compared to what they've got in America, that's a fantastic choice, really. You know, let's be blunt about it. But I think with this latest thing, you know, the Hitler stuff and whatever, Kamala Harris, it reminds me of Rick from The Young Ones, who just screams fascist, you know, and the Dems generally. They just see fascists everywhere, and everything and everybody they don't like is a fascist. And I think the problem is, the truth is, the word has been so devalued over the years that actually when people use it now, I think most people just sort of roll their eyes and kind of say, oh, here we go again, kind of thing. And it has less and less impact because it has been so devalued. I really don't like Donald Trump at all. I wouldn't vote for him. I wouldn't vote for Kamala Harris either, to be fair. But I don't like Trump. I loathe him as a human being. And I think it's extremely unfortunate that America has been presented with this choice. But I'm not prepared to call him a fascist. I'm not prepared to take the easy option and to pretend he's a fascist. And it is the kind of go-to thing nowadays for hyper-liberals to brand people with that term, anybody or anything, as I say, who doesn't accord with their particular worldview, mm-hmm. Gets labelled as far-right and fascist and neo-Nazi and bigot and nativist and all of that sort of thing. And we saw it in this country, didn't we, over Brexit, you know, the sort of fallout from Brexit. We saw a lot of that. Trump saw it in 2016, I think it was, when he was first elected, all of those, you know, accusations of fascist and so on. But, you know, there is the point that whether you like him or not, he does, and this sort of thing, I don't think will necessarily hurt him. I think, as you said, it's not necessarily going to work, and there will be, you know, his core audience, people, for example, in the Rust Belt, you know, those left behind communities in America who have seen industry decimated, who have seen thousands of good, solid blue collar jobs shipped abroad, those communities that feel left behind by globalization, those forgotten about communities. And they feel, rightly or wrongly, that actually Trump speaks their language in a way that the kind of increasingly hyper-liberal, middle-class, West Coast, you know, Democrats don't. And when they come out with this sort of stuff, I don't think it's necessarily going to hurt him at all.
And I think it's also
amazing, though, isn't it? You know, a New York liberal, effectively.
Yeah.
represents flyover country.
Yeah.
It's just, it would be inconceivable in any other era and in any other person than Trump.
Absolutely. I mean, the other thing I just wanted to pick up on there briefly, Paul, was that I think it's worth saying that to oppose the devaluing of some of these terms or the inflation of a term like fascist or racist, it's not just about, I think, being fair to Donald Trump or being fair-minded to any of these particular candidates. I think it also comes at a cost when you take the meaning out of these words. I mean, I think we've seen that even with, say, some of the kind of upsurge in racial hatred that we've seen not only on our streets recently, but obviously online around the riots in the summer, was that people who weren't just concerned about immigration, people who were kind of explicitly racist, far right and whatever, they now have a kind of cloak to hide behind, which they call all of us this. So why don't
blend into the mainstream, don't they? I mean, once upon a time, you know, in the 1970s, when far right and fascist had more of a meaning, you could look at the National Front when they were marching through places like Leicester and other towns and cities with high numbers of minority ethnic communities. And you knew what it meant. You knew when someone was marching around with a skinhead and a bomber jacket and Doc Martin boots and swastikas and so on, you knew that they were genuine fascists and supporters of far-right ideology. Now, if you label pretty much anybody, you know, from people who support Brexit to people who believe that actually there aren't 85 different genders or whatever it is, if you label all of those people fascists, then how great it is for genuine fascists that they say, well, actually, they call you lot that as well. So why should you believe that I'm one? That's what people are not thinking about.
And just before we wrap up, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the bizarre kind of diplomatic spat which emerged between Keir Starmer's Labour government and the Trump campaign. I'm not sure if you two will disagree with this. I think it's fair to say that this is to a large extent kind of confected. There was a small number of Labour activists who had arranged to go out to campaign for the Democrats in the US. I think there was one particular LinkedIn post that Elon Musk or someone came across. And since then, the Republicans have managed to turn this into a full-blown scandal. Ian, if you've got anything to say on that particular issue, please do. But if nothing else, the prospect of a Keir Starmer premiership and a Donald Trump premiership at the same time could be quite interesting, not just because of this spat, but just in general, surely.
I think the technical term for this is bollocks. You know, to be honest with you, you know, Nigel Farage has gone out to help Donald Trump as well. You know, if you want to talk about one side, we need to talk about the other. But in effect, what difference are they going to make? They're all limeys over there.
They will almost certainly send those voters in the other direction.
Yeah, I don't think this is kind of big news at all, to be honest. Mm-hmm.
And Paul, what do you think? The idea of Keir Starmer and Donald Trump being in post at the same time could be quite interesting. As I say, not just because of this, but just what two different characters?
A marriage made in heaven, I think. Keir Starmer got a bit of criticism a few weeks ago when he met Donald Trump. I think they had dinner together or something, didn't they? But I've got no issue with that. I think, look, if there's every chance he's going to be elected. He's going to be arguably the most powerful man in the world. America is a close ally, whether we like it or not. I think it would have been bizarre, frankly, if Keir Starmer hadn't sought to establish some sort of relationship with him. I've no doubt that Keir Starmer thinks absolutely nothing of Donald Trump's politics, and probably vice versa. But you need to have a working relationship. And, you know, if they're both attempting to do that, I don't think that's a bad thing. My sympathy is with the poor Labour Party staffer who innocently asked if anyone fancy going to America and has caused a major international diplomatic incident. God knows where she is at the moment. She's probably gone into hiding, I would imagine. But it will prove to be a non-story, I think.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.